Thanks for listening to R&Q's Device Love Podcast. You're about to listen to an audio-only version of our weekly show, Device Love Live. If you're interested in having your questions answered live on a future episode, visit rqteam.com to see what topics are coming up and to register. We hope you enjoy this panel discussion, and if you do, please subscribe.
All right, so let's jump right in by starting with the issues. What are some common issues that you're all seeing? Want to start, Nancy?
Sure. I always really like to harp on is the device description itself. So many times the questions coming back from FDA are just basic misunderstanding. Didn't understand how the device worked, didn't understand the features, didn't understand that maybe we had engineered out something that might have caused a problem in past generations of that kind of device. So just really start with the device description. Go into way more detail, give it to somebody that doesn't know the device so that they can really look at it and understand that device.
How about you, Brian?
Yeah, I just want to echo everything that Nancy just said. When I was at FDA, device descriptions, I mean, a lot of the times for orthopedics, it's simple pieces of metal and plastic, but sometimes they got complex, especially with unique instrumentation. So I was never afraid to ask for either CAD animations or even just videos of the device. So I would sort of have those at the ready, even offering them to the reviewer, even if they don't ask for them. I even went as far as to ask for device samples. Of course, a company can refuse to send them, and it's understandable if they don't want to send something, you know, expensive in the mail, but other times they're fine with it and we sent it back, but it's especially helped with if we had surgeons, medical officers on our team. I mean, every surgeon likes to play with toys, so we'd bring them a new toy to play with, and they would get used to the device, and it would always help us. So I agree with Nancy completely there.
Kevin?
Yeah, completely agree. I think the top three RTA1 reasons I've had are probably incomplete test reports, inconsistent data, and then device description as number one. Especially as browsing these complicated devices, or you have like a de novo device that like a brand new technology, sometimes hard to understand from just a 2D engineering drawing. So sometimes seeing like the actual sample or a CAD rendering of it is very, very helpful.
How about you, Mike?
Yeah, actually, I would agree with that from the device description standpoint. And I just add too, I think it just you know, one of the things I like to remember when I'm crafting the narrative of the description is that in most cases, FDA doesn't actually have a physical representation of your device. And so while you want to make sure that your device description is consistent with your IFU, your labeling, we got to remember and keep in the back of our minds as we're crafting this narrative, we're actually trying to paint a picture for FDA of this device that they don't have in their hands. And by the way, if you craft that well, or don't craft it well, I've also found that description and the way that we handle that will set the tone for how FDA actually reviews the risk of that device throughout the rest of the submission. So I would agree that description is super important.
Okay. Wow. Sounds like that is a big issue, deficiencies on device descriptions. So Brian, in reviewing, what other kind of issues did you see commonly?
I think Kevin hit on the big one is inadequate test reports. Mm-hmm. Usually if you get a deficient device description and let's say it makes it through RTA. So maybe backing up a little bit, before we could potentially refuse to accept for inadequate test reports, but now as long as there's a report there, technically you're just supposed to approve it and move forward. But I always thought of test reports. So I used to be a teaching assistant at in university, and I would think of reviewing test reports as like I'm reviewing a lab report from a student, and it's the basics. It's sort of understanding the test setup, understanding what standards you're using. It's very simple, and I think getting a fresh eyes to review your 510K before submitting it will work wonders for you because it's the first time. What tends to happen is your project team gets used to your device, used to your testing, and it just kind of you kind of maybe gloss over things that somebody with fresh eyes would pick up on right away, especially with respect to things that aren't clear. So yeah, if your test reports aren't clear, if they aren't written like a good college lab report is supposed to be written, then you're not going to have a good day.
You know, it's interesting talking about test reports and reviews to accept. So, you know, we see lots of companies who maybe will submit some old testing in the submission, like especially around biocompatibility, to kind of get in that 2-month queue with FDA, you know, while they're waiting for the fresh testing to come. So if you see and refuse to accept that that's probably old or that's just not good, what's in there, can you do anything about it, or do you let it go until the review?
So that's hard. So I think back in 2016, before it used to, you know, before that 2016 guidance, they said you would leverage that long history of use of devices and leverage predicate for materials and manufacturing that isn't yours. But after that guidance, now it has to be to demonstrate equivalency in not manufacturing process, which makes it very difficult if you choose a predicate that's not yours. So where it gets tricky though is in the RTA phase, if companies who are not familiar with all the up-to-date guidances say we are identical to a predicate and they list it, that would be enough to make it past the RTA bar, since it's not, FDA is not doing a substantive review during that phase still. What they may give you though is like an addendum to the RTA saying, hey, we flagged this as a heads up. And depending on who your reviewer is, and this is something I used to do, was that if I flagged these big issues early, I would maybe try to like RTA one for a different issue and raise this, hey, I noticed a big testing issue. Instead of trying to resolve it while you're on the clock, I'll give you an opportunity to try to address it before you come in.
That's good. Okay. All right, good to know. What other common issues have you seen, and like, what's your best practice to overcome that issue?
I think just keeping track of all the guidance documents. I think everyone's familiar with the device-specific ones for their specific device, but there's all these other overarching guidance documents that also apply to just all devices in general, like the biocompatibility one I just talked about, as well as like the new sterilization one that affects cleaning and sterile implants. So I think just being aware of all the guidances, not just the specific ones related to your device.
Yeah. And to kind of go along the same pathway with keeping on top of guidance documents and as an extension standards, I think it's really helpful that your R&D engineers, and that you should empower them to own the guidances and the standards that are applicable to them as well. I've worked for companies where it was the expectation that regulatory knows everything with every standard, which gets to be a lot, and every guidance document. And granted, we're supposed to know a lot about most guidance documents, but if there's a sterilization specific guidance or biocompatibility, the folks who do that in your company should know those guidances as well. Likewise with standards. And I think if you empower your engineering folks to keep on top of those as much as you do as an RA person, I think that will reduce unpredictable questions from FDA, because they'll get their experts involved in biocompatibility, sterilization if needed as well. So that's something that I really try to push. And I've worked for companies who do that, and it works so much better. I mean, it's magical when companies do that.
Yeah. I think one other thing that I like to do is I like to keep track of all the comments I've received. So if you're submitting your fifth, you know, device of the same type, I don't want to make the same mistakes I made on the first four. So if I've got that spreadsheet or that database of all those prior comments, you know, I've either built those into my template so that I know not to forget it, or I go back. So I want the reviewer's impression to be, oh, they really did listen to me last time and they did fix that. So, you know, kind of build that credibility that I'm competent and I've got this under control.
No, it's amazing how often we've seen, you know, business units in large companies do that well, but not share it across. Have you seen like some best practices for these large companies to be consistent?
So
across the company,
Nancy mentioned templates. Just in terms of overall 510K construction, templates are a great example. And I also think it's a great example to plug in deficiencies maybe as hidden text in your templates. But you're right, with big companies with a large RA staff, I mean, there could be a dozen or more 510Ks working at one time. So it's it can be hard to keep track of all those deficiencies. I mean, hopefully you don't have a ton to keep track of, but if you do, to have sort of a central repository. And before you even start writing the 510K, just look at what FDA has sent to your company recently, because there is the expectation from FDA that, okay, we sent this deficiency to company X for this one particular device. The expectation is that, okay, now every device that comes in from company X, they've seen this and they're going to apply it to their next 510K.
I think you see that inconsistency also, sorry, on the FDA side as well, where you might see some regulatory practice that are being applied in one office that might be different than in another office. You know, if you take some recommendations that are specific to your device area or something, and you try to apply it somewhere else, then you know, be aware there are some inconsistencies between offices on the FDA side as well.
Yeah. And even sometimes within the office, right? We see that, you know, the person that was reviewing human factors for that group has changed, and now it's somebody else, and they have a whole different approach and desire list. So it definitely has to be fluid.
Oh, definitely.
Right.
Let's talk about refuse to accept, because it seems like this happens often now. FDA is using refuse to accept and kicking it back, except I find device companies are always shocked when it happens. they're not expecting it. So Mike, what are you seeing around this?
You know, one of my favorite hot buttons and what I've seen often in RTAs is just these, I couldn't say enough, can't say enough about what Brian was mentioning. I think Kevin mentioned too about guidance documents and how important they are, and actually providing an adequate submission to FDA. The fact is FDA spends a lot of time putting these guidance documents together, and often these documents specify scripted information that needs to be in the 510K. And by the way, in many cases, will provide you a test path, and in some cases, a simpler description and level of information in the 510K. If organizations don't follow these guidances, I mean, look, let me take a step back. So they are guidance documents, and I've heard this question before. Well, they're just guidance. They're not regulation, right? Well, yeah, that's true. But FDA treats them as regulation. That's the scripted path they follow. And when you miss large sections of these guidance documents, they're going to kick that out, because you're not meeting their expectation. And so I can't say enough about this. Research the guidance, get your general guidance, your device specific guidance, and know those, and collaborate with engineering too. I'll echo again what Brian said, that too often regulatory is saddled with understanding the technicalities of all these guidances, when really it needs to be a play on both teams, engineering and regulatory, and in a lot of cases, quality. So collaboration is key, but understanding those guidances, it's a must.
Yeah. And I think it gets down to the details, right? So know of one situation where test report, obviously everything has to be translated. So they translated it, but the stationery they were using coming from another country had a different language in the header and the footer. So it was the company name and address, but it couldn't get through the RTA process. And I think they, you know, didn't have a great rapport with the person doing the RTA, because they wouldn't tell them what was wrong. They just kept shooting it back. Oh. You know, no, not good. So I can't tell you how many times this company went over the RTA trying to figure out what it was. And it actually took several months before they finally figured out it was the header and footer from the stationery. That the test report was translated, but the header and footer weren't. So that was holding them up.
Must be in English.
Well, that's crazy.
On behalf of FDA, we apologize for that, for not clarifying what that was for. That goes without saying, that's just bad practice to not say why you're RTAing a company. I mean, that should never happen.
Yeah. But I think it goes to that relationship, right?
Exactly.
Because I've also had, you know, where you submit and the person calls you and says, hey, gosh, you know, I'm going to have to RTA this unless you want to fix this. Can you email it to me right now? And I'll swap it out for you. And like that relationship stopped an RTA from happening because they were they were there ready to and willing to help get it fixed.
Yeah. And they've been pushing to maybe enforce four-part harmony a little bit more in our deficiency writing and feedback. So hopefully that helps address some of those kind of unclear feedback issues.
I guess sort of going back to the question about RTA and how to avoid common RTAable items. I mean, one, you can look the checklist that's available online. It's the same checklist that FDA goes through. So just go down the list. And I've worked for companies where they fill in that checklist for FDA effectively, and they put it into their 510Ks, and that's when you have that filled out and you point to every section where all the information is located, there isn't much that FDA can do unless they really want to nitpick about a non-translated header or footer or something like that. But I also think that making sure that you have the right folks reviewing your 510K before it goes out the door. So I guess I wouldn't expect somebody in your company to go through the RTA checklist and check your 510K. But just in terms of overall readability and completeness, it's important to have a good quality check before your 510K goes out the door. I've worked with companies where it's just basically you as the regulatory engineer and then regulatory management, and then it's out the door off to White Oak. But I've worked for other companies where it's quality looks at it, marketing looks at it. I think what would be great is if it was sort of a requirement to have, like we've said, somebody with fresh eyes. So for a design review for a DHF, you're supposed to have somebody who's not involved in the project, but who's an SME in whatever, participate in the design review. And I think that would be a good practice for 510Ks as well.
Yeah, I always include the RTA checklist, right? It's easy enough to go through, and then I can tell you what page exactly to go to for that, because I don't want my 510K 90 days to clock to be delayed.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would echo the same sentiment about that independent review and how important that is. And I know maybe from a business perspective, a lot of folks might think, well, I don't want to wait an additional 3 days to submit my 510K, but that sure is a whole lot better than waiting an additional 2 or 3 weeks after you get an RTA. And then you have to go back through the loading process and back through your admin review. And
yeah, I definitely agree with putting the page numbers in the RTA checklist. But something else from an FDA side that could potentially add time is depending on the time where you submit your RTA. So I think FDA tries to be as interactive as possible to try to address as many of its deficiencies as possible. But if you submit your RTA, say, right before Christmas, when FDA's got a lot of reviewers are gone for 2 weeks, the one person who's stuck there will get like 20 RTAs. And if he can't interactively resolve any of those issues, they might just end up RTAing wanting to meet that 15K deadline. So just being aware, I guess, like when you submit it, you know, I think they try to do as much interaction, but they potentially may have to resort to that RTA one just based on workload.
Yeah, too. I feel like they're giving us the benefit of the doubt so often, but when we all try to shove in a whole bunch of 15Ks before Christmas, it's probably going to hold us to that RTA, right? Okay, wait, I have a couple questions from the audience. One tied to what I was talking about before. Here, let me put it up. Wouldn't handing in old or arguably not sufficient documentation like old biocomp data just to get in the door reflect poorly on your manufacturer from a reviewer standpoint? Or are they understanding?
It would reflect poorly. I mean, assuming it's picked up on, it would. Yeah, it would reflect poorly. We understand companies wanting to get in the door quickly and get the clock started, but it really benefits you to have your ducks in a row. And that means having your test reports just up to date. Like, don't try to play games, I guess. Be upfront, be honest, give FDA what they need to review your file.
Yeah, I will say too, I think we certainly see companies say like they're supposed to do like long testing or long biocomp, and it's not done yet, but it will be done by the time they get put on hold, and it will reduce their overall time. But I think in some of those situations, I tried to resolve as many issues interactively as possible to avoid that hold. But if I know there's a big hold issue just looming, I'm not going to waste my time dealing with little things. I'm just going to throw everything in a hold letter, which might make that hold letter a little bit more burdensome than if we were able to address things like little by little over the period of the review.
Hey, thanks, guys. Sorry, allergies got to me in the middle of my moderating. So, next one. Do you have tips on letter to file documentation? Who wants to start that one?
Yeah, start with the guidance, right? So you've heard that a few. The other is, you know, it's all going to be revealed, right? If someone's in there and they're digging and they want to know how many changes have you made to the device and did you really justify, you're better off, I think, just facing it, right? Here's the 5 changes we've made. This is the cumulative effect. Here's the situation. Here's why I don't think I need to resubmit my 510K, and build your best argument. I'd much rather have that discussion with an investigator or with the center about why I thought that was an adequate justification than I would to, oh, it was a minor change. I checked a box that said no submission required, right? If I've got a justification, that gives me a lot more leverage when I get in those discussions than if I don't have that good, strong justification where I walk through why it's okay and why I'm not impacting safety or performance.
Yeah, I would chime in too, just right on the coattails of what you just said, strong justification and strong rationale. You can't just use the guidance and circle the diamond that says there's no new issues of safety and effectiveness. There needs to be the why needs to be addressed, and it should be written to an engineering level of detail, not just I feel like this is whatever. I think too often it's easy just to go through the flow chart and just circle a yes or no, and then overlook that you really need to provide a good justification and rationale, because that's your bread and butter, what you have to stand on when FDA comes knocking at your door and they question whether you should have done a letter to file or not. And so I would go back to something that Brian said a little while ago. Engineering needs to play a part in that, especially when you get to questions like, do the results of V&V raise any new issues of safety and effectiveness? Somebody's got to answer the question if there are any unexpected failures. A lot of times regulatory isn't privy to some of the unique details of some of that verification work. So you really got to be careful when crafting that letter to file narrative, and
I think it's. And go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, no, and I think it's good, right, that you start with that strong justification, and that's your approach. But I think sometimes regulatory has to stand up and say, you know what, it's time, right? Mm-hmm. This last little change, you're right. I agree with you, engineering, that this is not a major change. But it's this little change on top of these 4 other changes that now, you know, I'm starting to get into the risky part, right? And I may justify it, but let's think about when are we going to submit this and how are we going to get it up to date with FDA so we don't run into a problem later.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think the point about assessing the cumulative changes made since the time of clearance is huge, because I feel like we've all seen situations where the first couple of minor changes aren't bad, but then you see this huge device and specification creep with all these little changes that, you know, were in tolerance, and then you keep moving that tolerance and changing it, and all of a sudden now you have a brand new device.
Okay, question from the audience. This one's in the chat box, so I'll just read it. Is it preferable to meet the standards that FDA list as consensus standards over meeting the latest version of that standard?
I guess I would say, sorry, Mike, did you want to jump in?
I can really quick. If it's not a recognized consensus standard, it's not recognized. You can apply an updated standard, but you've got to provide justification there where the testing requirements are different. So when we moved to third edition of 6601 and FDA still recognized the former edition, It's okay to design your device latest state of the art, but in your submission, you've got to explain the differences, whether they're significant or not. And FDA will, I mean, they understand how this works. They understand that they're a lot of times often behind the eight ball on standard implementation. But it's important to be really clear about that. So, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
Yeah, so also plenty of times where you can use non-recognized standards, especially for non-traditional test methods for different devices. And FDA will accept that too, as long as you have a good justification and the methodology behind it is solid.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. For stability data, is accelerated data acceptable or is real-time data needed to justify shelf life?
Accelerated is acceptable, but you've got to state that specifically. And there needs to be a plan for the real-time data. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say go ahead, Nancy.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think the other, right, is if you think about you're going to want to extend your shelf life as you get more data. So if you've got, particularly if you thinking like the IVD space, right, you may be launching with a short shelf life to start, but you want to have that extended as you get more experience with that product. Submit your protocol and your acceptance criteria. You know, and then that when to submit a change, you don't trigger that because you've already given the protocol and you've already said, I'm going to extend my expiry as soon as I have the data to support it.
That Here's advice right there, it was worth its weight in gold to prevent future submissions. Yeah.
Here's a good one that I hear asked all the time for our FDA guys. Do some manufacturers have not to be trusted reputations with the reviewers, like usual suspects? when reviewers see submissions come in from specific manufacturers, that they are more inclined to really dig deep because these manufacturers tend to push the line.
This is my pet peeve and hot button, but I'm gonna let you guys chime in.
Yeah. I will say, I think there are certainly some manufacturers whose RA divisions maybe have a higher risk tolerance when making some of these letter to file changes. Deciding when to submit to the FDA. But there are certainly other manufacturers, I'm more on the blatant side, who actually have been flagged for straight up lying to the FDA. And I think one of the examples that I've had was that we actually banned a consultant from submitting it. And we looked at all their files that they were associated with and reviewed all those 510Ks, and we found fraudulent data in a bunch of them. Wow. So that's on one end of the extreme where FDA does flag these bad actors and then take action against them.
That was not R&Q, right?
No. This was bad. And then this person ended up using a fake.
We would never do that.
Yeah, I know. This is horrible. This person ended up using a fake name under their wife or husband or their partner. It was just a really, really bad situation.
That is a bad situation.
So you're talking about in recognizing things like fraudulent data or difficulties on the 510K side, do you know, when you're looking at submissions, do you know if that client has a lot of 483s or perhaps a warning letter or something? And does that trigger you to think differently or do more in review?
So in this case, it wasn't. We just happenstance that we got lucky that we noticed the same exact, what this client was doing was basically copying and pasting the same test reports across different clients and just changing the header. So we noticed identical test reports across different devices. Yeah, it was not great. But for 483s and post-market driving pre-market, I think they are starting to see that more, especially with the total product lifecycle reorg, where now Office of Compliance, Office of Surveillance and Biometrics, Office of Device Evaluations all merged into one super office. So you're starting to see this post-market drive into your pre-market decision-making. So for example, they might ask more questions about what predicate you choose. If the predicate you choose has any recalls or any safety adverse events, they might ask you to address those same ones for your device. And it actually is built in now at the top of a reviewer memo to fill in post-market data.
Hmm. That's good to know. Okay, here's another one. From the audience, are there statistics for percent RTA by device class or review group?
There are RTA percent statistics. So for 510Ks, I think we're running just under a third are getting caught in that RTA process so far this year. But if you look at the MDUFA performance standards and reports, that gets published every quarter,
yep,
or so. So that's available.
Hey, here's the next one. How do you present to FDA a cumulative changes submission in a 510K? Is there a way to make it smoother? Catch up.
Yeah. So can I jump on this
yeah,
really quick? I just include a table of cumulative changes, and I just include design changes from the last 510K to now. And I would recommend you just keep it simple, keep it consistent with what your change notice, your change order process is the verbiage that's in there. And that's it. I always recommend keeping that table simple. So you're disclosing the facts, but then you're also putting in FDA's lap the decision to see if that's an issue or not. And simple's best in a tabular format.
Right. I think going through the details of your letter to file, which should have a lot of details in it, how you walk through the different flow charts and the guidance documents about when to submit a 510K and when not to, but you shouldn't give the answers to all of those questions that you have in your letter to file in your submission to FDA, because those could potentially be easy things to pick apart. Right. I mean, what's the worst they could say? Like, you should have submitted a 510K for this change that you made back in 2010. And then you say, okay, well, I'm doing that now. But the philosophy still holds that you should keep your summary sort of simple with the cumulative changes in a 510K.
And if you can bundle those changes with a device design change that would trip the wire of a 510K, mm-hmm, that could make submitting it to FDA and paying for a 510K a little bit more palatable.
Mm. Okay. How much time should you budget these days for a traditional 510K?
I use 4.5 months as kind of my general timeline. Yeah. You can look specifically at device history and for that product code. But if I were doing a timeline and I needed to plop in a number today, that's where I'd start.
Yeah, and like Nancy was saying, oh, sorry, go ahead, Mike.
No, go, Kevin.
Oh, I was going to say, just like Nancy mentioned, the MDUFA does, the FDA does publish their MDUFA quarterly updates. So I think what we've seen, if you look at from 2010 to now, it's been slightly decreasing, but you might see some peaks for review times when you publish like big overarching guidance documents. So you'll see like a peak in like 2016 when they published the biocompatibility and sterilization. But since then, it's been kind of a gradual decrease in total time to decision.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, one of the things I like to do is it just makes me feel better. I always go back into to roughly the last 2 or 3 years worth of data for that regulation and that product code and all the clearances that went through, whether they're special or traditional. And I like to plot those out from a minimum, a maximum, and a mean submission to clearance time. And all that's publicly available information. And what that does is that generally gives me a feeling of, it kind of gets my finger on the pulse of where maybe FDA's hot buttons are. And gives me a good indication of whether I need to be really scrutinizing against some of the content of the submission or not. But generally, what Nancy said is it's really close to 4.5 months a lot of the time.
Yeah, like I mentioned it. I think the total time decision for last quarter or last year was 118. Hmm. So yeah, right around that 4 months.
That's good. What about specials? Are they still getting done in 30 days?
Yeah, for me, so far I've actually submitted quite a few specials over the last several months, and I haven't had a problem yet. They've been cleared in the 30 days. But I think the important thing here to remember is in the end of, I think near the end of 2019, September, October timeframe, FDA released new guidance for special 510Ks. And while on one hand, it seemed like they opened up kind of anything to potentially a special, whereas before they would limit, you couldn't change the intended use, you couldn't change the underlying fundamental scientific technology, operating principle. They've actually allowed that now. And it seems at first like, oh, we can shoehorn lots of stuff into a special 510K. But remember, you got to get familiar with that guidance, because they've come up with this new, what I'll call an enigma phrase called well-established test methods. You can submit your special, but you need to subscribe to well-established test methods. That means those are methods that you previously submitted and were reviewed in a 510K. and that you have the same protocol, the same acceptance criteria. Otherwise, maybe you've gone through the rigmarole and you've got a medical device development tool approved with FDA, or you're going to be able to dig back into some scientific literature or publicly available, widely publicly available testing criteria and method, and you're going to pull that into your submission. But so it's, in one hand, there's a lot more things that could be changes that could be submitted as a special, but the rigor that we have to put into the details of that special 510K now actually increased. And so you're, the time to prepare specials is actually increased. And it's a little bit more difficult. It's not a walk in the park, kind of like it was, you know, a year ago.
But to Mike's point, I think since they have been expanding what is allowable in a special, is definitely a more appealing choice to make, especially because I think FDA does hit that 30-day timeline in like the high 80%. So if you can fit that change in to a special, that still might save some time overall.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Nancy, is it working out for you? 30 days?
Hey, my last one was 14 days.
We'll take that.
Yeah.
Let's see. A question from the audience. Have you experienced an FDA request at RTA to include V&V evidence for cumulative changes included in the table?
I have not actually received a request for that, but I think if you did, that would be pretty much a simple thing to provide. And I would do a summary. So as a part of any change that you make, if you've lettered to file this thing, that's fine, but FDA expects verification and validation to be conducted at some level. The idea that you're going to have a change, a design change, and it's not going to have any V&V attached to it, that's a slippery slope right there. And so all you would need to do is just pull the results of whatever V&V stated on your change notice or your change process would be and tabularize that for them, summarize, and then summarize.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the change is. So one that I've seen was a company said, oh, we just changed our MR labeling, not a big deal. And I'm like, oh, that's supported by testing. Like, that cannot just be like a statement. We need to see the actual reports. And that would become an RTA-1 issue. But depending on the change, it may not trip that wire for RTA-1. But that doesn't mean they won't ask for that V&V evidence during the SI phase.
Okay. So what is FDA doing to try to smooth out the process? What should we know? What do you think, Kevin?
So I think they've been adding more interaction and more opportunities, like the 10-day call or the flag throwing pilot for the 510K to address remaining issues. I know customer service actually was a prior CDRH strategic priority. So I think you can kind of see that still as like a remnant in all their new programs that are coming out.
See, anyone else? Brian, anything new?
I mean, they're certainly coming out with guidance documents fast and furious. I mean, when I was at FDA, it was laborious to get a guidance document out the door. And I think Jeff Scher and the center director kind of realized that, and he really pushed folks hard to get guidance documents out. And I think by and large, they've been helpful. I think there are, you know, sometimes the ambiguous phrases that Mike was referencing in the one guidance document. But to me, when you tell industry what FDA is thinking, FDA is using these guidance documents too. I mean, if they get a submission with some technical detail that has a guidance document associated with it, that reviewer is going to be using that guidance document as well. So I think it's been great to see the volume of guidances that FDA has been putting out.
And I think theoretically, the reorg should also is intended to be one of the methods to smooth out this process. So for an example, appeals now are staying within the same office. Appeals before used to go outside of the specific review division. But now, since everything's becoming a super office and it's becoming a little bit more, I guess, like more levels of management in between, appeals for 510Ks would stay within the review division, which should help since you're getting someone who's very familiar with that device and you can get that appeal meeting a little bit faster. So I think that reorg should be helping, especially with some of the leveraging of the pre and post market data as well. So it remains to be seen since it's so new, but That is, I think, one of the goals of the reorg.
I think it's important to remember, too, that FDA has a vested interest in making sure that that submissions come in the right way and go through the right way, because they have MDUFA timelines, you know? And so I've seen, so I think one of the things they've come out with is the Q-sub process, and that's to help clear up confusion in the submission process, right? So we have access to FDA now through the Q-sub process to get questions answered. Now it's a very scripted process, and you've got to be familiar with that. They are trying to make themselves available.
Okay. So getting back to best practices, what do you do when you get a request for additional information? You know, what's step
breathe. One? Breathe. Just breathe. And before you send it, read it, right? Like, you know, it's kind of like the story problem in math. Read the problem. And then when you've done that, read the problem again, right? And then really understand what they're asking for. I think that's what gets people in trouble, right? You jump to what's in your mind, what you think they were going to ask about, instead of really reading the question that's coming in and what's the basis for that question. And it's okay. Stop and, you know, give the reviewer a call and say, I just need to clarify this, right? Like, I don't understand what you're asking for. It's a lot easier when you are solving the right problem to get to a solution.
So you call them. So Brian, do you want to get those phone calls? Did you take those phone calls?
I took them. Some of them I liked. Some of them I, you know, maybe I put off for a day or so. I mean, there was an earlier question about, you know, is FDA aware of bad actors? And we sort of talked about it from maybe the 483 manufacturing perspective, but also from the human relationship perspective. Yes, FDA is very much aware of people who are bad act, just who are always argumentative. Even if you're asking a simple question, even if you have a strong scientific basis for asking a question, it's just argue. And it's, I mean, there's a lot of introverts at FDA, and, you know, arguing is not something that we want to be doing. We want to work with you. If I have a good working relationship with an RA engineer or an RA director or whoever the interface is with the company and FDA, I mean, it just makes it so much easier. I always welcome those calls because it would often smooth out the process.
How about you, Kevin?
Yeah, so I think for me personally, I'm with Brian. I think the more interaction always helped, but I think you might find some mixed sentiment on the reviewer, because you see some of these programs come out, like the 10-day call was intended to try to reduce some of these interactive communications, because I guess in a reviewer workload, the files that are placed on hold are no longer on their official workload. So anything they do afterwards is just not reviewed or clocked anywhere. Right. So I think some reviewers you might find wanted to reduce that amount of interaction. But I personally, I think I always encourage it still. And I think you can kind of get a sense from a reviewer, but I think that always, I always found it helpful.
Mike?
So I think Brian just kind of segued right into my soapbox. I think it's important to remember what I'll just call the human element to FDA. I think sometimes we think about FDA as they're these automatrons or these robots that are just following these scripts, but they're really not. They're humans with real lives and real worries and concerns. And when we do things that compromise the relationship and put a bad taste in their mouth, it affects things later on. Do I think that FDA has got a list of bad actors? Probably not, but they're human, right? I mean, if a company leaves a bad taste in their mouth in one place and then they turn around and get another submission from that same company, subconsciously, it's really impossible to separate the two. And we got to remember that the company rapport is critical and key with FDA success here. And I know that's ancillary to what maybe a lot of people want to hear, but the way that our companies conduct themselves with FDA affects the way FDA conducts themselves with us.
Yeah. All right. Good note to end on. We are out of time. Thanks, everybody.